In this episode, Ryan and I begin a conversation about the underlying nature of financial reasoning, and we specifically rely on Murray Rothbard's well-known article, The Mantle of Science. We had fun and hope you enjoy. Welcome to the Bank with Life podcast. I'm your host, James Nethery.
I'm your co-host, Ryan Griggs.
Happy to be here. So, Mr. Griggs, you have a... Well, here's a little bit of background that, you know, just transpired before we turned the mics on. You're going to be speaking toward the end of the month at an industry-type event. I as well. Two different topics, two different things. But you, in earlier this week, you know, Ryan and I talked frequently, and I'm going to blow you up here. So he's like, well, you know, I don't really know what I want to talk about. And I'm like, whatever you talk about is going to be beneficial. So, you know, just go think about what you want to say. And so he did, you know, 2 days later, you know, he texts me a picture of 45 page handwritten notes. And he's like, oh, I think I got it. So,
yeah,
we were just kind of talking about that and some of the things that, you know, came to his mind while I guess you were developing the talk. Share with us, you know, how we got to this great article that you may or may not reference.
Yeah. No, there's a lot there. So the article that we're talking about is called The Mantle of Science by Murray Rothbard, originally published in 1960, available on Mises.org. Just Google The Mantle of Science. But you probably wouldn't because it would seem very arcane. Like, why would this matter? I mean, Rothbard's point there is about something called scientism, which involves the misapplication of methods meant for physical natural sciences to the social sciences and the problems that come along with that. But the reason that that is even relevant, like the reason I brought it up, have it printed out, and we'll rely on it for this talk that I'm giving later at the end of the month, is that I think it kind of sits at, I think it explains something that like a Jordan Peterson will talk about, you know, the sort of the age of enlightenment that sort of grew up and became sort of a maladjusted teenager, right? It's like, there's too much, like there's a problem of excessive concentration. There's too much obsession with the, what we might call a technocratic or a technological or the physically observable, empirically observable, mechanical elements of human existence, right? So this is the mechanical engineering. This is everything with computers and AI. This is everything physics related. This whole trend, like the triumph of, you know, the man's attempt at rational mechanistic, you know, reasoning and production, right? That there's a sort of a cultural trend in that direction and a predominance, as opposed to like a more spiritually oriented, you know, without something with, that has more reference to human purpose or human desires or intention, you know, things that are less easily observed, less easily quantified, less easily mapped and tracked and all of this, right? That, so you have two sort of fundamentally different ways of viewing the world. And Rothbard in this particular article gets into the technical aspects of what it means to do science, but to do it with respect to social environments, to human beings, and how what it looks like to talk scientifically, but not to commit these scientistic errors. And that's kind of what the Austrian school is known for, right? Logical deduction, language, using words to talk through things and to make points and to argue rather than using strictly and only mathematical methods. Anyway, that's what the article is about. So what's that got to do with insurance or like the show or the talk or anything like that? Well, I think that the trend in the industry, and I think this is connected in certain ways to what happened with Universal Life in the 80s and in the 90s, is that we've mentioned recently this idea of capture, that there are, that there's like financial entertainment online that in some sense is captured by an audience that where the impression is what we want is bigger number sooner, better, right? Higher cash value relative to premium earlier. And the perception of that demand in the marketplace informs what the media people online and the agents online put out and talk about. And then the companies make the products and the riders and whatever you need in order to get that done. And this sort of reverse chain of influence that instead of running from the companies or from the industry down to the public goes the other way. It goes from the public up. And there are there are good versions of bottom up stuff like that. But and we could talk about like Nelson's what that would mean with respect to Nelson. But in this capture idea, it's we have essentially a vacuum, as I understand it, a vacuum where there's very little reference to economic purpose. And instead, just sort of this default instinctual recourse to like quantitative and empirical and observed methods of analysis, right? Like, let's look at the number on the page. It's the idea that the numbers speak for themselves. The data speak for themselves. You know, just look at the number that's bigger. That one's better, obviously. You know, that's just implied. There's really no argument from first principles or deduction or logical exploration of anything. It's just look at the numbers on the page, right? And my position is that that's manifesting in a certain form of business. It's with the limited, it's and it affects every level, yes, right? It affects the nature of the individual's activities in the marketplace with respect to like education and marketing. It affects the nature of policy design. It affects the nature of the advisory conversation. It affects the company selection. It affects writer selection. It affects premium level selection. It affects planning for how the policy may or may not be used once it's enforced. It affects the nature of service after the point of sale. Like all of these layers of interaction in this industry are affected because this type of attitude runs so deep, you know. And when I talk about it, and I talk about it at length, and it sounds arcane, and it sounds boring, and whatever, it sounds like disassociated, like there's this cognitive dissonance, like why would I care about how people think about the way that we justify or argue things, like why would that matter to me, what am I, like I'm just doing my life. It's like, well, it does matter, because I think it's what's underneath. I think there's a lot of explanatory power that can help people understand why things happen the way they do in the industry. Because one of the sources, besides you just saying, hey, say what you want to say and it's going to be helpful, which that was a very helpful comment.
Well, lot of that, I mean, I hope I inspired a little bit of this.
You have.
From a previous conversation, like the day or two before. So now it helps me understand, but I'm and I know you're going to get there, why you're bringing that forward, because I'm right there with you.
Yeah.
That multiple levels, and that's exactly what's going on. So keep going. Didn't mean to interrupt.
But. No, you're good. So what I think this kind of thing does is, like metaphorically, helps explain the landscape. Like it clarifies, it illuminates the map, right? It kind of explains what the territory looks like and helps us navigate it, right? Like if we can understand why is that over there? Why are, you know, agents or online media people X, Y, and Z, why are they talking about this insurance stuff in this way? Why are they referring to that company or this company? Why are they referring to this or that premium design or premium structure? Why am I noticing certain patterns out there? And people are looking, if you spend enough time online and you have a pulse, like you're going to notice patterns with, I'm not telling anything anybody doesn't know, right? The different individual programs or outlets online will have a certain form to what they talk about, maybe certain talking points or taglines or ideas that they constantly come back to or consistently come back to. And it helps to know why, like understanding why, I think, is what gives you the necessary intellectual or conceptual framework so you can establish meaning and figure out what to do, right? Like, I think that's why Nelson said, if you know what's going on, you'll know what to do. That's why I think this stuff is relevant. And if you see it that way, you can start to, there becomes a spectrum where on one side, there's maybe a more Nelson Nash style, a more Nelson Nash oriented approach, where there's going to be you might expect a certain company, a certain type of company and product design or product choice and contract and a certain form to that business. And on the other side of the spectrum, there's basically buying a modified endowment contract. I mean, there's doing as much the opposite of what Nelson teaches as possible. And a lot of that looks scientistic to me.
It's all looks, feels, smells, is.
Yeah. And I think it's why, like, and what do I mean by that? Well, a lot of the analysis, to the extent that we can call it that, really is just about looking at numbers on the page. You don't get, the nuance goes away, right? There's this compression, and this happens everywhere. It happens in economics and in academia. It happens anywhere this kind of positivist, scientistic mentality reigns. You get this compression of all the variety and all of the nuance that might ordinarily come with a human, like, service oriented type, all that goes away, right? Because the goal is to commodify. It's to compress all that detail. We mentioned this on a prior show, like, that the nuance in a high volume, high turnover environment is costly. And so if we're optimizing on the, just strictly by the numbers, then that costly nuance needs to be compressed and hopefully eliminated to the extent that we can and still get the job done, in order to truly optimize in that whole framework, which is why it tends to go away, which is why I get calls from people. I know you get calls from people who have policies from other people. They don't know why they got them from the company they got them. They don't know why the product, why the premium, why the structure. They don't know. But of course they don't know, because there was no reference to purpose in the first place. That's out of place in that whole analytical approach. It's not reference to purpose. It's reference to differences, observed differences in numbers, you know, that guides the whole thing.
It very compressed. Yeah. The why is very narrow, very shallow. When that activity based in the scientific, form, and just the commodification, it just narrows. It's almost like any argument within the life insurance industry. You've got to narrow the argument down, your position down to one single point, so you can, get paid human action, why it's human action. Somebody there is getting paid is why they do what they're doing, mm-hmm. and then the other, the potential buyer, the individual that may want to learn specifically about the infinite banking concept, they either a lot of, and I'm not trying to pigeonhole anyone, but the presentation was really good. Mm-hmm. The product was commoditized. They narrowed it down to a few particular points, not first principles, right? The first principles are out the door when it comes to infinite banking, but it looks good, bigger number, must be better, so let's go. But mentioning, and all of that's human action, and why does that go on? Because I think, and where this makes great sense to me, and I was kind of waiting, like, okay, how are you going to make the connection here, Mr. Griggs? But it's beautiful, because you just can't leave out human action, paroxology with Rothbard, and I'm not the economist. Mr. Griggs is the economist, not me. It gets narrowed down. It looks good. They didn't go in depth. It was shallow. And I'm specifically speaking to why people market the way they do, and then the people that participate in that. Mm-hmm. It's the argument's narrowed down. It's overly simplified. But then, you mention Nelson's name or his books or in passing reference or really hardcore. But the first principles are completely jumped over. So the researcher, the learner, the one that's interested, it is, in my opinion, not everybody wants to, get that deep into the economics of a particular decision. Right.
Yeah. No.
But
yeah.
It's absolutely available, and because there are a lot of people that do want to get into it. But then, and here's where I really want to go or wind up. When you said you receive calls, I receive calls, they don't know why they bought the particular company or paying premium to a particular company. They know little about the structure and why it matters. Mm-hmm. And then with a certain passing of time, different for everyone, they discover, maybe out of application use and a combination of continued learning, it's like, this is not what I bought. You know, the company may be fine, you know, whatever. A lot of things may be okay, but this is not what I bought, right? And I wanted this, what Nelson was discussing and teaching and demonstrating. And then they see if they can do something different or should they do something different, which causes a whole nother process or a continuation, expansion of thinking and why, right? And then sometimes you're out, you know, it's like, it's too much, whatever the solution may be, mm-hmm, right? They're like, no, I'm out. But most of them are like, yeah, I'm all in because this is what I wanted. And then, you know, to reference, I made a note while you were talking, so the listener may need to, you know, reverse it and listen to Ryan again. But, you know, I've heard many times, I'm sure you have, and I know some of you have too, that Nelson was agnostic to policies or companies. You know, whether direct recognition, non-direct recognition. And no, he was not. I personally never heard that come out of his mouth. Of course, I didn't hear everything he ever said. But Nelson was not agnostic to life insurance policies or companies. Did he own dividend-paying whole life insurance? Yes, he owned dividend-paying whole life insurance when there was a static PUA, right? And he owned policies with the dynamic PUA where there's a potential for fluctuation in the premium to the PUA. He owned direct recognition and non-direct recognition companies. That does not mean he was agnostic, right? So I love the it's the human action to me is what stands out.
Yeah.
You know, I love Rothbard.
Well, I just like going into this type of depth because for me, I want to find like the rock bottom, you know, like anchor the argument there,
yeah, right.
You know, and the bigger number, sooner, better thing, higher cash value, earlier thing at the root of that body of thought is, and this is linked back to this article, to Rothbard's Mantle of Science article too, is a sort of assumption of, he calls it servo mechanism, but like enslavement to the calculation, to there's a sort of automatism, right? That everything's just algorithmic. You know, if there's a change in the data over here, there's,
well, what engineer doesn't like that? No,
absolutely. Insult. It's an equilibrium type concept of a physicalist equilibrium type concept that there's this automatic equilibration going on, and this isn't how people operate, right? There's
not at all.
We haven't. So the contrast to that automatism, that determinism, is free will. It's saying no.
Oh wait, and we're human.
Stop, right? Yeah, like the buck stops here.
Yeah,
the individual chooses, and that is what determines outcome.
Your choice may be very different than my choice, and should be
right. Which is to say that the core, the sort of essence of the higher number, bigger number, sooner type approach, the implied, inarticulated, but present core of that is just inappropriate for like what we're doing as human beings, right? There's a misalignment that those two things don't go together, right? Like at the core of what we might call an advisory approach or an advisory perspective shouldn't be just this, you know, automatic reversion to observing differences in the magnitude of numbers. It should be a recourse to your reasoning and to purpose. And what I mean by that is, like, to what degree is the proposed solution helping to solve the need for controlling the banking function? Like, that is what I mean by linking what we're doing in IBC, linking the choice of company and the policy design and the premium level selection and all of those elements of the advisory process, linking those back to the fundamental purpose of what we're doing with IBC, which is to control the banking function, or in economic terms, to accumulate and deploy capital in the most optimal fashion. That should drive the question, right? That should drive the decision-making process. And if you take that approach, if you agree with that, what I'm telling you is that the form of the outcome is going to be observably and noticeably different than if you just kind of went with the flow and kind of just grabbed onto whatever the more high volume, high turnover online media, financial entertainment type person would send you. You're going to notice a difference. And it seemed, based on the calls I've had, that seems to be helpful to people who are like, why is it there seems to be all these debates or disagreements or different positions about companies and design, all the things that we've talked about. What is the reason? And I think, unfortunately, you got to go kind of deep into this stuff that seems, I know, arcane. And
well, you don't have to go that deep. And, you know, this is, you know, a good reason why I'm, myself included, an awful lot of people that enjoy listening to you and enjoy reading your writings may need to refer to a dictionary from time to time. But the, I mean, it doesn't have to go that deep. But the why, you can't leave out the why. You know, why is that? Why is the commodification the way it is? You know, there's a reason for that. I don't want to spend that much time with you. I have a limited understanding. And I want to be profitable with the amount of understanding that I do have from the agent, the advisor. And there's no disparagement here. I'm just walking through in my own mind, in my own perception. You know, then from the consumer, I just want to get to what Nelson, you know, taught and promoted that you know we actually can become our own banker, like you said, and control the banking function. And then that's very broad, right? I may want to make this better. You know, is so slow, you know, comparatively to, you know, other things. And everybody makes decisions comparatively, in my opinion, my experience. And then what happens whenever that attempt is made, even especially by the agent and advisor? So what happens in why does that happen? Because I'm mutilating, I'm playing games with numbers on a page, I'm manipulating numbers on a page to make certain things happen sooner. Cash value be higher, death benefit higher, whatever. So I think there's the why is completely jumped over on multiple levels, as you said earlier, that when it comes to the economic thought and the scientific background of why these companies build the products that they build, right? It even goes up to them. And you said, you know, earlier on many levels, it absolutely includes a life insurance company. They're trying to make products that the agent will sell and the consumer will buy. And never forget, you know, we've said it many times, and it's not original, you know, there are no deals in the life insurance industry. Well, there are no deals anywhere, if you really want to get down to it, right? However, when the life insurance company builds products, you cannot forget, I mean, it doesn't have to be a driving, you know, part of your decision-making process, but you must understand that the life insurance company, every insurance company, yes, they're in business to be profitable and deliver products. They are going to do everything that they can do to mitigate the risk against them. So when they create these products that the agent will sell, whether some of these companies have built products, you know, for the infinite banking concept, right? They came out with a dynamic PUA, all for a reason, right? And I'm just saying, when they do that, there's nothing, including their new product design, there's nothing that they do that doesn't mitigate their risk against them. Why is there a limitation on the flexibility of a PUA premium? You know, why is there a point in time that if you don't adhere to that contract as far as paying the minimum amount or the required amounts to the PUA premium, that right is no longer in existence on the policy? You know, so... And that's not to say a bad thing. If it's a mutual company that you're participating with, you want them to be profitable. You don't want them to forego mitigating their risk. But the agent and the advisor and the consumer, you know, need to understand their product, in my opinion. And I was laughing even earlier, chuckling to myself, you know, but, I mean, we have regular conversations. And I think, I don't know if you knew, or we discussed, I think we did somewhere along in our previous conversations of the last couple of weeks what I was going to talk about, but they just fit right in. You know, yours is at the economic level and mine is at the you and me level. Not that yours doesn't translate, but
no, that's fair.
And which I love that, you know, every time that I recall speaking at whatever venue, if there are other, you know, knowledgeable agents within the infinite banking footprint there, most of the time all of the talks are pretty consistent. But I think every time, even if we have an outside, say Ryan's speaking, I'm speaking, and there's an outside listener, without choreographing, right, and sharing what you're going to talk about, topics or whatever, titles, they're consistent and they're congruent.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which I love that, which then speaks to the way we think.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, these so a lot of the times, I think the things we talk about, we're just hitting from different levels.
Yeah, absolutely. And
explaining in different terms. And there are different levels. And I mean, I know that part of the pushback here is like, okay, because nobody like in insurance or thinking of, you know, looking for a financial strategy wants to hear about, you know, categories of intellectual endeavor and, you know, metaphysics and ethics and logic and, you know, the history of intellectual development. I get it, but my point is it's here if you want it, right? Like there's more here, we can go deep. And I would think that for somebody who wants to implement a very serious, long-term oriented type financial plan that you would want to go to this depth. But look, I get it. People are busy. Not everybody wants to. My point is that it's genuinely here. I'll point out a couple things that Rothbard mentions in this article. You know, he talks about the Econometric Society, which is in economics in the 19th century, is the establishment of publishes one of the leading journals. I think it's called Econometrica. That PhD economists want to publish in order to get tenure and promotions at various universities. In any case, their initial motto, their original motto is the science is measurement, right? It's this very, maybe sounds peculiar idea, but it's this attitude about what science is, what the pursuit of correct knowledge is in form, in character. That it's a very particular idea that it has to do with observing countable differences. And I know maybe that sounds weird. It sounds generic. It sounds like, okay.
It sounds pretty simplistic to me.
And I mean, like, yeah, I can count. Like, you know, counting helps create knowledge. And that's true. What I'm talking about, what the problem is the misallocation, the misappropriation of that kind of intellectual method. Like the empirical, like attention to observable reality, that's great for everything involving non-human stuff. You know, it's great for talking about electricity and like water dynamics and anything physics related, material stuff, you know. But when we come down to reasoning correctly, rightly, truthfully about human behavior, we have to use different methods. Right? We're not just going to the right answer, quote unquote, is not going to fall out of a calculation, right? A mathematical calculation in the way it will for activities we do in other domains of life, right? In the so-called natural sciences, as opposed to the social or the human sciences. And so we should, my point is we should observe that, and then we should look at the character of our arguments, and the goal should be to use the kinds of methods that do comport with, that do align with, that are sensible for our stated purpose, which is to solve a human problem, right? To solve the banking function, to achieve an explicit human goal, right? Financial goals. And what is that? What is the implication then for like an individual purchasing experience? Well, it's looking at things that might matter for those purposes, you know? So that's going to affect things like company and, you know, this whole process starts to unravel, right? Layers start to become clearer as you progress through and things start to get more specific and more high resolution. And I would think that that's what somebody would want, right? Like to reason from with sound techniques that align with the appropriate domain of study, human interaction rather than physical sciences, and then to develop a very clear, individual, practical, sensible plan for that person from those theoretical depths, right? Like if you could line up all of that and connect all of that, that to me is very strong. And I think it's very, and so people who go through that, I think, well, then if they want to examine the nature of the marketplace, they go, well, why is it that there's all this kind of variation going on? I think you could approach it and say, yeah, this kind of makes sense. I get it. There are people who are just running the numbers, man. It's the high turnover type stuff. Okay, that is what it is. And that's why I've come to that position. It's like, okay, right and wrong, let's just set that aside. Let's just talk about whether we're using appropriate methods. Does this align with the nature of our subject or not? And then, you know, are you even interested? Some people don't, they want that. They want the high turn and burn stuff.
Absolutely. And then there's a why behind why they want it.
Yeah.
And then there's a why behind the outcome.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so I get it. I think that, you know, once you do something, once anyone does something, there's an engineer. And I'm not, listen, I love engineers, okay? I'm just using you as an example. Or a mathematician that'll math it out for you.
Yeah, and this is not to say that there's never a place. I'm not, I get this impression all the time that people think, like, if I argue for one position, I must, like, want to, like, burn and, like, vilify the perceived alternative. Like, that's not the case. I'm not saying that there's no place for crunching the numbers and all that. There is.
Absolutely.
But that should be properly ordered. In fact, that's kind of my whole point, is that things are disordered, right? We sort of by instinct, like, this kind of guttural, like, default instinctual thing, like, oh, look at the numbers. Like, we have to start there and then we kind of piecemeal it after the fact.
Yeah, right? Justify why.
Yeah. Like, the mutual... All that matters with, like, the mutual fund by term and invest the difference thing is that there is some alleged positive annual average return. Yeah. And everything else you kind of piece together after.
Well, then
there
are two different things. You're just bringing in another component with the average annual return or returns in general, right? If you're speaking anything beyond the premium and the death benefit. So there again, we got to narrow down the argument. That's a very, almost a 100-year-old argument now, you know, term. Whole life, and it hadn't really changed much.
No, and there's a whole branch of entrepreneurial theory in, like, what might more broadly be called the Austrian school. A guy named Israel Kirzner at George Mason University, who I don't know if they'd use the term Austrian anymore, but Israel Kirzner was, he got his PhD under Mises, so sorry, you're stuck.
Brandon Mason.
He has this idea of entrepreneurship, which I think is wrong, where it goes along with what we're talking about. Like, the like good entrepreneurship is just successful responses to observed differences in numbers out there, right? Like, his classic idea is the idea that entrepreneurship is basically alertness. You know, if you're walking down the street, you see a $100 bill on the sidewalk, you're alert to that. You pick up the $100 bill. That's like successful entrepreneurship. Whereas unsuccessful entrepreneurship is like a failure of alertness. You fail to see the thing.
Narrowing it down.
Which doesn't make sense, right? Because then there, in that paradigm, there's no loss. Mm-hmm. If you're just never sufficiently alert, okay, you're never sufficiently alert, but you don't actually lose. Whereas in real economic reality, people do lose. So I think the vision is incorrect, but that's kind of my point. It's like there's this his conception, this major conception in Austrian economics today is that, you know, the fact of a difference in numbers, right, plus 100 versus not plus 100, that fact is supposed to just magically account for causality, right? Like, that is supposed to be like what automatically you do that, right? There's this quantified difference somewhere, and that just ipso facto explains action.
So the blind and deaf guy would be a failed successful or just a failed businessman because he's not a lawyer.
But you see how that's silly. Like, it is. We would have to explain, if you really wanted to explain why things happen the way they do it, you can't just say, oh, look, those numbers are different. You have to say, okay, well, why? What does that matter? Why with respect to the individual's purposes does that matter? Like, what are the trade-offs? What are the consequences? This is one thing that I find that's always kind of silly. It's like, when I'm talking with new people, it's like, okay, we don't even know why it would matter, what the differences would be between direct and non-direct, for instance,
right?
Or the use of 1 year versus the use of a 30-year or long-dated level term rider. Like, the idea that there could be meaningful consequences to doing one or the other, just that idea, not heard of before.
Then you add the fact that the future is unknown. I mean,
Right. Makes, and what are those to results going to be? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So the idea that we're going to piece together a bunch of like trains of thought, like the, okay, the policy is treated with direct recognition. There's annually renewing term on it. And I have a very high PUA and very little base. Like I'm going to, we may not see this on the page, but over time in reality, because at issue that policy assumes the original, the current experience of the company,
yeah,
that'll change. Real life is not going to happen just as illustrated.
Premiums won't ever vary. Nothing changes.
Right.
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 Yeah.
So
nothing.
Life will happen. Things will change. And then in order to understand, in order to actually, to truly understand what the effect would be of those types of reasonably likely things, one has to reason through with reference to the individual's purposes, like the idea, for instance, that I might want to pay a substantial premium for a very long time in a tax favorable fashion.
I love that. The you know, and I'm going to cover an awful lot of this in my talk, but the idea of a young person having, you know, knowing that the future is unknown, we know that, right? And we could reasonably presume that a young person, let's say they're 30, 35, and they have their profession or they're being educated in whatever their, you know, profession is, right? The idea that their income will likely go up is never in the is never in the consideration.
No.
Right. So I'm gonna buy some short dated whatever policy construct, knowing that I'm gonna age, the banking function is not ever gonna end or go away. I'm always going to need a place to put money and have as much control over it as I can get contractually. But the idea that my income or my success won't increase is, and just leaving that out of the equation is beyond me.
I know.
It's beyond me. Maybe my health changes. What's the likelihood of that occurring as we age? And that's not accounted for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the only, I don't want to say the only, but it seems like in financial planning, in retirement planning, in life insurance, in personal finance, you know, the companies have their boxes that, you know, fits the broad consumer potentially, and they're very uncomfortable to get out of their boxes.
Yeah.
All right. And then they're training, you know, the agent, the advisor. So the agent and advisor is typically trained within these boxes and is very uncomfortable to get out of those boxes.
Or notice that you're in one.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. Yes.
And that's the part about this that might could be uncomfortable to some is that this sort of explanation about the character or the form of the analytical approach, what matters, the nature of a given analytical perspective, like that might be irritating or like frustrating to talk about. But the more irritating and frustrating thing is like it all is. Like everybody who approaches some sort of analytical question approaches from a certain paradigm. Like there are certain intellectual presuppositions that whether we know it or not that we're making. Right, because we argue in certain ways, the language and the approach to argumentation we got from other people, and that's based on certain intellectual presuppositions that are there in the background, whether we acknowledge them or not. And I think, therefore, it could be helpful to acknowledge them and try to put some words on them to understand what's going on. Because one of the benefits is you might start to see why we get this feeling that I sometimes sense that different people online are sort of talking past each other, right? Like different outlets online, different sources of information about insurance or about banking more broadly. They'll use the different slogans or you notice a different form. And if we stop to look around and ask what our sort of intellectual presuppositions are, we might start to be able to make sense of that. Like it might start to make sense. Like the sort of spirit of modernity that we're really talking about, the sort of technocratic, postmodern, hypercritical, deconstructivist, just ultra literal, heavy on the number type approach, this big data, AI, computational mania, like sort of the spirit of our age, you know, it's pervasive. And that in our particular domain, I think we can talk about it in degrees of formality. Like I probably talk about it pretty formally, you know, in terms of the philosophical structure.
No question.
But someone like Nelson, I would say, is still operating from the where I'm coming from, like this classically Austrian type domain. It's just a different degree of formality. He's much more approachable, right? It's much more like not basic in the sense of
simple,
bad,
but not in a bad way. The simplicity is a virtue. Brevity is a virtue. You know, clarity is a virtue. And I think all of those virtues, among others, are, Nelson personified them, in my opinion.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that if somebody wants to go further into like the not so easily observed elements of this, like if you care about the structure of the argument, if you care about, you know, whether a certain approach aligns philosophically, intellectually, as it should, then there's a lot here. Like you could go, this is, again, it's called The Mantle of Science. I think people would enjoy it. And I think it does help explain why things kind of happen. Earlier on, I mentioned that what is going on nowadays has a, and maybe it was before we turned the cameras on, I forget, but we had a similar series of events happen in the 80s with Whole Life 2.
Oh my gosh.
And back then, it was all about cost minimization, optimization around the death benefit, right? How do we get
well? That was a front end benefit argument.
Well, that's the core of universal life is annually renewing term.
I understand.
The whole idea there is cost minimization of the death benefit. The whole buy term and invest the difference type thing, that's all a cost of death benefit.
I get it, but too, there, you know, I think you've even printed them and have them somewhere. I know I have them, but the transcripts from 88, 86, I think it was 88, whenever, I mean, so there's and more
C-SPAN
behind that.
The Senate hearings?
Yes.
June of 88.
June of 88. So there's more behind that than just the cost of the death benefit. The
of
argument.
Course. I'm not saying, of course.
So I'm just saying that there are other articles there that can give you a broader perspective, you know, although it's presented that, oh, the whole life is, you know, unclear. It's a tax loophole and the cost is too high comparatively. And then, there were other dynamics going on behind that. And then the life insurance companies come out and say, oh, well, okay, we'll create new products.
That leverage different approaches to pricing death benefits.
Yes.
Right. But, which is my point, is that at the core of all that, yes, are there all these other features? Absolutely. There were special interests. There was collusion. There were all sorts of other. But I think the main bludgeon that colluding interests use was – and the nature of the exact argument itself doesn't even matter. The form of the argument is what I'm saying is like what they were reasoning about was death benefit cost considerations.
Right.
And nowadays we just have the other side of that same analytical coin, whereas it's not cost minimization with respect to the death benefit that matters. It's growth maximization with respect to cash value that matters. The structure of the approach is the same. Like what people were trying to do that ultimately ended up with universal life and all of its attended failures in the 80s is the same thing in form that people are doing today with the cash value growth obsession. And it's going to have a similar form of end.
Yes.
Where people may not be hurt outright, like, you know, even with universal life, claims eventually got paid. You know, they were paid from not where you would expect them, but from the state insurance commissions that got the funds from other companies. But it worked out like it was fine. It was just not what people would have expected.
Yeah.
And that same phenomenon, that same form is going to happen again.
Yeah. Well, it'll play out. Work out for?
Right. It'll play out not as expected. But in the meantime, all the people getting paid on the transactions do get paid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the same form.
Mirror image. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The same form when Wall Street broadly looks at life insurance and does all the analytical analysis, takes the human factor, the human action out of it, that we all have free will and act totally independently for our own best interest. And maybe that, you know, benefits others. Oh, wait, you can't practice capitalism without benefiting someone else that you had no intention of benefiting. Same form. Those are really those we did talk about those two, three things, right? Like in previous phone conversations where, you know, the buy term and the best of difference, these insurance companies, not in a negative way. I mean, it's just factually, they come out with new products and the analysis of why they do that is their own, right? They have their own why.
Yes.
And then the other arguments, in addition to the cost of the death benefit, premium versus death benefit, you know, permanent versus term, the accumulation factor, you know, okay, so now we're going to focus on accumulating capital within a life insurance policy. There's a why behind that. And then the manipulations to artificially make that happen. There's a why behind all of that. And it all, absolutely every bit of that has to do with human action on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. And the why matters ultimately. If, you know, if I'm going to buy life insurance and I'm going to practice becoming my own banker, then there's of course a why behind that. I don't want to be beholden to the third party lender. You know, maybe I've been beat up personally by the banks in the past. Maybe I just am adverse to paying interest, whatever. Everybody has their own why, right? But then when you get into it, it's the why behind, you know, some of these other, a broader why beyond your own matters greatly. Yeah. And specifically, you know, I harp on structure, get beat up on that. And structure does matter. Because my needs and goals and desires are different from yours and yours and yours and yours, and rightly so, right? So whenever, if I don't understand the first principles of something, right? And I take an action, whatever it is, my action would be, maybe, my opinion it would be, but potentially much better suited if I understood some of these whys without becoming an engineer, without becoming an expert in the life insurance industry or the financial industry. And, you know, and I know we're all inundated with information, but if I understood the why behind a structure, if I understood the why behind a company selection, if I understood the why behind riders or how it was built, the outcome of that is there's going to be a higher probability of success in light of, in face of, knowing full well that the future is unknown. Okay, look, this one is coming in two parts. So we're going to end here and pick up where we left off in part two. And I believe personally, part two gets better. So don't miss it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.